Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. In the Drink's the show that brings you the most interesting people of the beverage community. And I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. Before we get started, I'm going to give myself a little plug because it's my show and I can do that. We are taping this show over the summer. This is the end of August and we'll probably air it middle of September. And I'm excited for the show. But I've made a little bit of news over the summer. I am actually involved in a new restaurant. I'm opening a new restaurant in the former Franny's space, a much loved restaurant by myself and many, many, many other people. And I hope very much to do it justice and be as much a restaurant for that neighborhood and of that neighborhood. The restaurant will be called Fausto, and I'm hoping to create a Southern Brooklyn wine destination. This is actually something I learned recently that Park Slope is actually South Brooklyn. I didn't know that. I thought that would be more considered Central Brooklyn, but no, it's considered part of South Brooklyn. So I hope to be a great restaurant in that neighborhood with Chef Aaron Chambora, and I am excited for that. Another thing I'm excited about is today's show. In the studio today, we have someone I kind of think of as a real sommelier. Everyone I know looks up to him in the industry. He is now the beverage director of the Grill and the Pool, soon to open the pool, or no, just recently opened the pool. His name is John Slover. He is here in the studio, and I'm so excited, John. Welcome to In the Drink.
Thank you very much, Joe. I'm very excited to be here. This is a great honor.
And John, thank you also. I know you were at work this morning and came in and going back to the Seagram building. That's pretty awesome. I appreciate that.
My pleasure. It's no problem at all.
I imagine it's a busy time for you with a newly minted 3-star review. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we were super psyched about that.
I dined recently, and I can say it's well deserved. And if and more so, it was just a fun theatrical experience. Our server or captain, it was Martin Gobi.
Yeah.
Who, to give you an idea of the kind of talent working at this place, yeah. Martin had been GM and director of operations of Franny's and their other restaurant, and he was serving. I mean, it's amazing.
He was a captain at Babo in like 99, 2000. He's been around.
He is the man.
Yeah.
Another Brooklyn local resident, I believe. We also live close by in Brooklyn. I realize that there's a lot of wine industry people
I know.
Our neighborhood.
Right. We could put together a kick-ass tasting group.
If we had the time or, time, I guess, to do it, we could do it. Yeah.
We have the willingness and the wine. Yeah. We don't have the time.
Yeah. But there really aren't like a ton of places to drink. Like, where are you going to go and drink a great wine? Like anything that you have on your amazing list.
Yeah.
Like, where could you find any of those wines by where we live?
I mean, I have yet to go to Beasts and Bottles, but it's on my list to go to. And I don't know that I haven't looked at the wine list. I don't know if it goes back far in vintages, but it certainly has a lot of excellent producers and excellent wines. I looked at it online a little while ago.
Yeah.
And then you could always make the pilgrimage to Da Tomaso in Diker Heights.
You know, what a legendary place. Yeah. I've actually never been, but I've heard of people like drinking incredible wines for a low price. Has it been like well picked over at this point?
It has been, but there's still a ton of stuff.
Can you remember like a recent or a bottle that you're like, oh my God? Because like what a great feeling. It's something that you know, I think they did well at like Marta and Maialino, finding wines that people who know and love wine and know what maybe they cost in other places. Like, wow, that's so low. I wasn't planning on spending $150, but I'm going to do it because
that's like $1,500 somewhere else.
Yeah, something like that. Do you remember any like wine experiences like that, Da Tomas, like
tons,
particular wines?
I mean, we're talking about 13, 14 years ago, friends and I drank a bunch of 68 Mastro Berardino Tarazi Reserva and different single vineyard 68s. We've drunk a ton of Giacosa Red Label, 78 and 82, 82 Gaia, sorry, San Lorenzo.
Oh, it sounds like, so this isn't even like accidental. Like this person is like, I'm just going to buy the big names. Like they actually know what they're doing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Actually, I remember we found a bottle of 78 Grand Cru White Burgundy in the cellar there. I forget the producer, a good producer. And as Tommaso was opening it, he said, you know, I really wish this was 79, not 78. Because 78 is great for reds, but 79 is great for whites. And so it just shows, you know, there we were, like a group of people from Cru and from, being schooled by this amazing older Italian American guy from Diker Heights about the differences, the fine nuances of differences between white and red vintages in Burgundy, and old Burgundy is hysterical.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. And from what I understand, that for a while Manducati's had a similar situation.
Same. I haven't been to Manducati's since then. I've been to Da Tomaso since then. But I had a bunch of really terrible meals at Manducati's. Maybe one good one, but like the food was, to me, sort of a joke compared to how great the wine experiences were. So I never really went back. But they may still have a lot of stuff. Who knows?
Yeah, and at that point, you can just buy the bottle retail, and it would and make better food at home. And it's not worth it.
Yeah, but I do remember having at Manducati's a bottle of 78. Barolo from Fontana Freda, and it was $40.
No.
You know, it's crazy. At that point, it doesn't matter who made it or what it's like. It's mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. It's a great experience.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's incredible. Okay. I do want to ask you all about the opening, and I'm just really excited for you, for this restaurant, for New York, and all of us who can dine there. But we actually got a listener question. That doesn't happen too often, to be frank. And maybe that's because I never tell you guys how to get in touch. And so if you ever want to email me, you can email me at joe@annonawine, annonawine.com. Annona Wine is my hobby, something I do in my free time. But email me at joe@annonawine. I will respond. And if it's a good question, we'll answer it. We'll answer it on the show. And I think this is a good question. It's an interesting question. And I assume it's something that other people who, especially people who are kind of like tuned into social media and Instagram and following some sommeliers might wonder as well. The question is from David Walsh, who's based out of San Diego. And David writes that it appears to me that the wine industry, and Somms in particular, are largely driven by fashion, trend, and hype. Fashionable right now are the wines from the Jura, orange wines, grower champagne, etc. While there are thousands of other wines in areas that make even better wines that have either not been discovered or people have become bored of, it seems to me that the Somm community is sometimes a little lemming-like, and that when the Somm with the loudest voice discovers a wine or a region, the trend, hype, and fashion begins and the industry follows. While I understand that the wine industry is sales-driven, do we not risk missing out on valuable wine experiences? So there's a lot to kind of unpack from that.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah,
but I kind of wonder what your thoughts are in general. I mean, I know you've you know, you've been in the industry in New York since 2000 or so. You're part of the you're the opening beverage director at Blue Hill, which is amazing. I'd love to know more about that.
Sure.
So I imagine you've seen the industry through various phases, availability of certain wines kind of coming and going.
Right.
How does that kind of strike you in general, this idea that there's people are driven by like what's trendy and hype and that sort of thing?
Well, I guess I think there's, I mean, I have a mixed reaction to that comment/question because I've thought the same things before, you know, when you're looking at through Instagram, the same wines and kinds of wine pop up among the sort of wine intelligentsia.
They keep, you know, showing pictures of Auvergne and
Right. And but I mean things, also like, you know, you could pick some producers in the Northern Rhone. You could pick Barolo producers. You could pick.
I'm sure I'm guilty of this as well.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
but. The fact is that in the 60 seconds that someone is out there Instagramming a picture of something that they're drinking, that they like, maybe they want to lock into this community feeling like, hey, this is a cool wine, and look, I'm drinking it too. Meanwhile, they probably have 23 hours and 59 minutes in the rest of their day where they're doing other things and probably exploring other wines that maybe they don't feel like Instagramming. So I would say that. If you're looking through the view of Instagram, there's a lot of like very narrow sort of trendy wines that are out there that our sommeliers are excited about. But I think there would have to be a better kind of analysis of what their wine lists are like. Mm-hmm. Those sommeliers and those wine directors, do they only have trendy wines in their wine list? I doubt it. And are there other wines besides these trendy wines that turn them on? And probably yes. And I'm sure that there are some sommeliers that are guilty of only following what other people think are cool. And all right, I mean,
Do you feel that the trendy wines are wines that, you know, for the most part are very high quality wines that just a bunch of sommeliers have? It's not wines that are trendy.
No, of course not.
There's a reason that they're trendy.
Yeah, because they're, you know, on the whole, they're great. I mean, if you look at like, I mean, I think Dovizioso is pretty trendy and Ravino are pretty trendy, meaning people, all the wine buyers, I don't want to buy those wines. They're great wines. It gets a little bit more confusing when you're talking about someone like Auvergne,
it's almost impossible to buy. That's very
possible
very
to buy, and some people love them, some people hate them. Mm-hmm. I don't know anyone who really hates Dovizioso. You know,
no, I would not want to dine with that person. Actually, it would not be fun.
Yeah. By the way, I just drank a bottle of I forget what it was. I sort of missed the Jura. Trend, although I had some wines at Blue Hill in 2000. I had some Vangione and I had some other things. I had a Poulsard Rosé by the glass, like a light-colored Poulsard by the glass at Blue Hill, mainly just because I was exploring wine and I found a wine that I really liked a lot, and so I poured it by the glass. Or a Vangione went well with a dish that Dan Barber and Alex Urania made, and so I bought that, and you know, I was always turned on by things that were off-kilter, off the beaten track, and like that. Now they're not off the, I mean, they're still off the beaten track, but obviously much more central. But in any case, it's a little bit more, you can't deny that Auvergne and other Jura producers are making incredibly high quality wine. They're just very, very individual and maybe don't have mass appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit more confusing, but yeah, I think there's a huge overlap between what's quote unquote trendy and what's also incredibly high quality, incredibly well made, long lived, and really intellectually stimulating and pleasurable as well.
And one of the other things that's kind of tied up in that question is this idea that because sommeliers are posting oftentimes similar wines, that's dictating what other people are drinking.
And sure, yeah.
I would. something I thought about is like there, when it comes to sommeliers posting on Instagram, there really isn't so much a like Robert Parker effect other than maybe Raj Parr. Right. If Raj Parr posts something, then everyone's
going to go after it.
People go after it. Right? Yeah, I don't know how many other like other people there are who like have that kind of like sway with Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Who knows? I mean, yeah, I think there's little pockets. But yeah, Raj has pretty big reach. Yeah. He has long arms. That Raj Parr. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Yeah. Listen, I My dirty little secret is I don't really drink that much. I taste a bunch, but I don't really drink that much. And consequently, you know, I haven't a lot of the wines that that we're talking about, mm-hmm. I haven't actually tasted. You know, I haven't. I maybe tasted here and there, but I haven't really sat down and drunk a bottle of Auvergne in a long time.
Yeah. And that's something that's interesting that happens a lot with, you know, with us in the industry, too, is that maybe you get to taste like an ounce. I think like you work the La Palais.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Every year, and I've done it for the last 6 years or so, and we see each other there. I get to maybe taste like a half ounce or an ounce of
And then you have to make a judgment and hopefully, you know, form an opinion about something.
Have I had this great wine before? I guess, but like that's not really. It's not the same as sitting down for a bottle or really
at
like
least
when
a glass.
Or at least a glass.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you really learn wine, you are a particular wine. So if you've had it a couple of times,
right,
with different food, can, different family,
right, and hopefully over some like with some time passing between wine. I mean, that's the whole thing. Wine is something that ages, and it ages slowly on its own schedule. Mm-hmm. It doesn't like bend to what we want it to be, and possibly like one of the dangers of this, you know, quote unquote trendiness is. It accelerates the consumption of wines that should probably be drunk more slowly. Possibly, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, it was an interesting comment that the listener made for sure.
Yeah, that is interesting.
I'd love to hear. I mean, I don't have time to sit down with this person or whatever, but it would be interesting to get a list from that person of the wines and the regions that they think are getting short shrift. Mm-hmm. That because they're not trendy, and to like taste them with that person, to see like, yeah, okay, this is, you know, because everyone's palate's different and maybe like a region that they like, I don't like, or, you know, who knows? It'd be interesting to like, it's a little bit cynical, the comment, but I feel like it wouldn't be cynical if he or she put forward suggestions for what they think are getting short shrift and what they think are quality that are being overlooked because they're not trendy.
All right, David, so if you're out there, you can send me a follow-up email and I'll discuss it with John at some point, hopefully over, you know.
A bottle of Auvergne.
And we will Instagram and hashtag up. And you mentioned that I know that drinking wine with some age is something that you like to do. I had a Bourgogne Blanc at the grill. It was like a 2010 Bourgogne Blanc.
Buying
stuff like that for me is amazing, right? Like something that is affordable. I can't afford Grand Cru white Burgundy from 2010, but and you usually see people having like a Bourgogne Blanc that's 2015 or coming up on 16s or something like that. So that's really cool. How do you? I know that's something that you've been interested in a long time, right?
Yeah. From the get go, I started learning about wine in '96, and it didn't take me but a few months to discover I had an affinity for older wines, or at least an interest, and then I started tasting, and I discovered that I preferred older wine to young wine. Although actually recently I've gone back to preferring younger wine and not older wine, but whatever. You know, it's like you go back and forth over the years. But I mean, one of the most interesting things about wine that I learned from the beginning and all along through my career is how wines age and how they develop more subtlety and more nuance as they age and sort of become more harmonized and turn into something else that's greater than the sum of its parts. When they're young, you taste the structure and you taste the different things that are out of joint with each other. And over time, all those pieces come together and form a sort of harmony of balance. And I think that's interesting and fascinating, and one of the most stimulating things and one of the most pleasurable things about wine. And it doesn't have to be Grand Cru, like you're saying. It's wines have their primary, secondary, and tertiary as they age. So something like Chave Hermitage, that lifespan takes place over 30 years. Mm-hmm. But a Bourgogne Blanc, that lifespan takes place over 5 or 7 or 10 years. So you can get a tertiary wine that's not super expensive. It may not reach the heights of greatness that Chave Hermitage does or a Grand Cru white Burgundy, but it doesn't have to.
Has it become easier or more difficult to find these sort of lesser, I mean, not lesser wines, but like less, let's call it, I don't know, less exalted wines with some age on it. I mean, because that's not stuff that you can like call up your distributor, right?
Right.
But I remember when we opened Del Anima, I was able to get a bunch of, you know, like simple, like Barbera with 10 years of age on it pour that by the glass. And that was amazing. I loved that.
Yeah. Do you get that locally or you got it from a distributor?
From a distributor, yeah, actually. Right.
Yeah, no.
Has that become easier for you to find or harder over the years? Or
I think developing good relationships with sales reps and wholesalers, and also traveling to wine regions and developing relationships with growers can facilitate having those things a little bit more available than not. It's a little bit of an active process. So when I started at Blue Hill, for example, way back when I literally had no idea what I was doing. I still knew that I liked older wines, and so every sales rep that I met and started to deal with, I said, if you have anything in your book that has some bottle age, even if it's a few years, let me know. Mm-hmm. So I had them all working, looking for those things. And managed to find a really great Copertino Rosa Reserva with about 7 years of bottle age that was cheap, and I poured it by the glass, and it was delicious. And actually, I remember tasting that same wine from the current release at a tasting around that time, and it was sort of unpleasant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like just 7 years, you know, a few years really softens the edges and you know.
It's strange that Pugliese wine, right? Yeah. Like there's a couple of producers that release them with some age to it. I think like Taurino.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Right.
Was it Taurino?
It wasn't. It was the Cooperativo.
The Cooperativo, right. And for some reason, like, I don't know why, but those wines, they're never meant to be, I think in their youth, they're just so like jammy and plummy.
Right.
And,
right.
But with some age to it, they're
beautiful.
They're beautiful.
Yeah.
Really cool wines.
They turn into like the fruit gets sweet, but not in like a cloying way, but just, you know, sort of mellows out and gets broad and sweet and really attractive. You know, I love that.
So what was are there any wines from the original wine list? What was your first wine list at Blue Hill like? And then are there wines that, you know, every wine list you've been on, like you've been part of, you always have that on because that's something that you feel so strongly about. You love those wines so much.
It's a good question. Well, the first part is that, at Blue Hill, I was able to kind of do exactly what I wanted to do. In other words, no one was telling me I had to have this wine or I had to have that wine. And the trends back then were very different than now. There was a lot. I mean, there's still a mass market for like big oaky, you know, tropical California Chardonnay and you know, big, you know, fruit bomb Cabernets and other California wines and modern style wines. And I guess I wanted to be a little bit against the trend. And so I think I opened with a list of 100 wines, and I think I had one or two California reds and maybe one California white, and that was it. And it was partly because I wanted to make a point of avoiding things that were that people thought you had to have a wine list. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But also it was that I was tasting the food with Dan and Alex. Alex Serrano was the original chef de cuisine or executive chef. And the food was very light. They didn't use cream and butter. You know, the food tended to have higher levels of acidity. You know, very clean, simple flavors, very intense flavors. And so, I mean, I just intuitively knew that big wines wouldn't really work well with the food. So I was picking, you know, lighter style wines with more acidity and less oak and less alcohol and like that. And those happened to be the wines that I really love, which I wasn't completely articulated in my head at the time, but, you know, was sort of more instinctual. And now those are the kinds of wines that I gravitate towards.
Right. And I think you see a lot of the sommelier community, at least here in New York.
Right.
Hey, but yeah, the sommelier community in a lot of places like sort of gravitate right. towards those low alcohol,
for
more
sure, yeah.
wines, right?
Of course, right. Yeah, no. And I mean, that's kind of a philosophical process, you mm-hmm. know, that's...
But it's something that happened organically for you in a way. You're like, I realize that these are... You know, it's now it seems like commonplace. Like people, it's like common knowledge that
right.
that those wines are better. If you have a very high alcohol wine with a lot of oak, it's just tougher to enjoy that
right.
with.
Well, it's
food.
A limited yeah. kind of food that you can have with that.
Yeah.
Well, and now I'm like, you know, buying a lot of big, you know, oaky, tannic, you know, high alcohol wines for the grill because we have, you know,
clientele who'd be interested in that. Yeah.
Well, not just that, it's a chop house.
Oh, it's a chop house. That's right.
Yeah. So we sell a ton of prime rib. We sell a lot of you know, ribeyes and strip steaks and.
You know, I don't think I'd ever had prime rib before, so I have no
roast beef.
It's but you guys give the little
very
the bone
good roast
as
beef.
Well, and it was spectacular.
Right.
But that's not even what I ordered. That's my girlfriend's parents ordered that.
Okay.
And I had the guinea hen Claiborne.
Right.
Which, I mean, what a fantastic dish. And like, what you can have so many like fun wine pairing opportunities with that
Rhone
dish.
Rhone would be great with that. North or south.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of... Because, you could do... you could do even like a slightly more tannic, more powerful style of red Burgundy. Like Gevrey or Pommard or
mm-hmm,
you could do New World. I mean, there's a lot of places to go with
and
that.
Could you maybe a Jura with that also?
Or a Jura, yeah. Exactly.
Would be really good. So then after your time at Blue Hill, you spent some time, you didn't go very far, like geographically, actually.
No, not at all. It's on one side of Washington Square Park or the other.
Yeah, so you went over to 24 Fifth Avenue.
Right. Right.
I worked at a couple of restaurants in that space.
Yes.
And you took a step back, right, from being a wine director to being a sommelier. What was that like?
Well, you know,
accurate?
It's on paper it's accurate, but I went from being the wine director of with a 100 bottle wine list and a one man operation. Of those, I didn't have a team of sommeliers or anything like that. To being a sommelier in a team of 3 or 4. But with 2,000 wines.
Wow.
I think maybe we opened Washington Park with 1,000 wines and grew it to 2,000 wines. And then we closed Washington Park, renovated, and brought in all the wine that we had been buying that we didn't have time to put on the wine list. And we opened Crew with 4,000 wines. So in the 7 months between restaurants, we added 2,000 selections. Obviously, we were doing a lot of buying.
I remember the Crew. I mean, I went to NYU and couldn't barely afford anything there, but you guys, the hospitality, I don't know if people realize, like, you guys were really great. And there was a little bar area, and sometimes I'd go in with my friends and, you know, you'd be able to find some, I remember drinking like off vintage Bartolo Mascarello, like 93 Bartolo Mascarello.
Yeah,
that was
that.
Actually like, it
really
was a
good,
stretch and really good and stuff like that. But 4,000, I remember there was two wine lists.
A white book and a red book,
That's crazy.
And like half of it was Burgundy. So we had 2,000 selections of white and red Burgundy.
Yeah. You can't possibly know all of the wines, right? Is it impossible at that point to know?
Kind of, yeah.
How do you
approach it?
It
depends on what you mean by know. I mean, if you want to know all about the winery, the history of the domain, the name of the winemaker, like their vinification process and all. Yeah, it's impossible to know everything about every wine, but you know, we
But as, you can know enough to
as
make
as you go. Yeah, you have time, a sense right? of styles. Yeah. You have a sense of climate and what the kind of what you know.
And there are a lot of verticals, I imagine. So
at Crew, yeah, Crew. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we had 2,000 selections of Burgundy, but we also had 10 pages of Napa Cabernet. We had a huge selection of Gigal Lalas and other Northern Rhones. I mean, we had a huge selection of Ryas. I mean, the buying back then was much easier. You know, it's a totally different ballgame now. And
is you're saying that because anything that you wanted, you could pretty much get, and things weren't like allocated like they are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there was less competition. There's since we opened Crew in 04. And since then, the collector community, people who, wealthy individuals who are interested in collecting and buying wines has grown dramatically. So there was less competition at auction then.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's, whatever, there's more people buying the same kinds of wines.
Yeah.
And, I think we one time we bought 3 cases of 78 Ryas. Now I see a bottle. A lot of one bottle of 78 Ryas here and there, and it's leaking, and the cork is pushed out, and it's like not something you really want to touch. 3 cases of 78 Ryas show up at the door.
Wow.
Yeah, there was someone who was selling. Robert Chatterton was selling Gonon back then.
Was he really? I didn't realize that.
We used to take 5 case drops of 89 and 90 Gonon Saint Joseph.
Oh my.
For nothing.
God.
$27 a bottle or something stupid.
Oh, my God.
It was on the list for, I think the 89 was on the list for $90 or $80.
That seems like a wine. It's probably to blame Raj Parr, but like that seems like a wine that just in the last couple
blame
of
blame Patrick Capiello on
Patrick
that
Capiello on Gonon. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Shout out one. To Patrick.
He's another one, I guess, who can like really, but yeah, it right. feels, it seems like in the last like 3 years or something.
Sure.
And again, to our point before, it's a truly great wine.
Oh, it's phenomenal. It's
and
phenomenal.
It's it's worth that. Right. That's like lives up to the hype. It's exactly. still a good value, even at the newly inflated
it's,
price.
It's now broken the $60 barrier. You can't buy it retail for less than $60 anymore. And even more than that, I've seen it offered for higher than that.
Yeah. But still compared to some of our favorite Burgundies wines in the world.
It'll be a value. It'll still be a value up to like $80, and then it'll still be worth buying. It's a really good wine. It's super authentic. Jean Gonon and I guess it's Pierre is his brother.
Mm-hmm.
They're like incredible winemakers and vineyard managers. Insanely careful in the vineyard. Insanely detail oriented. And, do they have the greatest of the great terroir? No, but they're making incredible wine to its potential from a really, really good terroir. It'd be scary if they had, vines in Bessard on Hermitage or something in Cote Rôtie. It's scary to see what they would make.
Wow.
But
we need to like come up with a collective.
I mean, who knows? Maybe they wouldn't really like it. Maybe they're very at home where they are, and they're not striving to make Hermitage or Cote Rôtie. But for what they make in Saint Joseph, it's like amazing.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think so. That was a special time that you were at Crew. I mean, what's some of your takeaways from that experience there? I imagine you tasted some of the like greatest wines in the world. Yeah. In fact, I know there was an event there that happened that was called the Greatest Wines of the Century.
Was it the 100 best wines? Yeah,
100 best wines of the century. I remember drooling and thinking about what was.
Right.
Yeah. What did you
take? Did you see the list of? I mean, how do you know about that? You just saw, like a post. Did
I don't
like
remember.
Doug Barzilay publish?
I think when it was happening, I remember there was some like promotion. I don't
right,
know how.
Right, right, right.
You know, I was working in the industry, and I think it was like $25,000 a ticket or something absurd. That I couldn't even imagine having that much money at
ridiculous.
A time. And
it was amazing. Yeah, I mean. That dinner and we did a lot of wine dinners for collectors and I guess a takeaway is that it's a very, very special and very rare. I mean, back then it didn't seem so rare, but now looking back, like I kind of wish I had taken better notes, you know.
Yeah.
I wish I had, like, you know, kept a better log of those things.
Of everything you tasted and what you,
Right. And every now and then I come, like, I'll, going through storage, I'll come across a box with, like, printouts of the wines we were serving. And, like, I remember a dinner we did for a group of collectors where the youngest wines were from 1945. And the oldest wines were from, like, 1892 or even older. It was maybe an 1870 Red Burgundy or something. I can't remember exactly, but...
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's, you know, at the time you take things for granted, it's like, this is going to go on forever, and it's not, you know. And now it's, like, really hard to have those experiences, and those wines are concentrated in fewer and fewer cellars, so, yeah, I wish I had taken better notes and recorded all that stuff somehow much better.
Yeah.
So
that makes me think. Another wine destination I've never been to, it makes me think of Burn Steakhouse.
Yeah, I've never been there either, yeah. I've always wanted to go.
Too. Place with thousands of selections, and they've kept them around for a long time, and some good values.
Right.
So then, sometime after that, I don't know if I'm missing, anything in the chronology, you made the trip all the way down to Houston Street to Bar
Henry. That's right.
Like, you traveled three blocks
instead of one. Meanwhile, I lived on Thompson between Bleecker and Houston.
You live on Thompson between Bleecker and Houston.
So all through that, I was like 2 blocks away from work all the time.
Did you meet your wife when she was working at Lupa?
I did, actually. Yes.
It's amazing. Yeah. Who's also a lovely and talented and amazing person.
Who worked with your partner, actually, Aaron.
She worked with Aaron.
Yeah. So she, I think when Aaron was Cruz's sous chef at Lupa, Shin was a sommelier at Lupa.
Yes.
Yeah.
I kind of think, said you're a sommelier. I feel like Cruz is a chef. Like, chefs love Cruz.
Yeah.
And then Erin, like, that's like her mentor. I think she followed him to 3 different kitchens.
Oh, so cool.
Mercer Kitchen, Lupa, and Del Posto.
Very cool. Awesome.
That's
I'm super psyched for Fausto to open. I can't wait.
Thank you. Thank you. I can't wait to have you in.
Cool.
Awesome. Hopefully it'll be one of the days where you're drinking wine and can dispel the myth that you.
Yeah.
So at Bar Henry, you did a really cool thing that the city, I don't think, had seen before, where you allowed people to order a half bottle of any full bottle that was.
Right.
And it's now been adopted at Charlie Bird and Pasquale Jones, perhaps, as well. And they give you a shout out on the list, which I think is very cool.
Very cool, yes.
I think, like, you know, you see that more with cocktails these days, too, where people, like, they're saying, hey, listen, this idea is from someone else, and I'm going to give them the credit for it.
And I think
that's super cool that they're doing that. do you remember, like, the thought process, like, coming, like, is it something that you do again? It seems like, to me, I think that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, it worked really well at Bar Henry. I did it at Chano as well, where it also worked really, really well. I actively don't want to do it at the Grill in the Pool, just because it's a much bigger operation. But yeah, I mean, basically, I just pulled together a couple of bits of things that I had heard from people before. You know, actually, I think it was Dan Lerner from Skernick who mentioned that maybe it was that one night he was at Crew, and I offered to serve him a half bottle of wine, and he mentioned that he had been a sommelier before, and that, you know, he did that occasionally for guests. It's just something you do occasionally for something special.
Maybe it's a table of two, and they want to have, like, one bottle of wine. Maybe they want to have a bottle of red. Right. And to start, maybe you have, like, a glass of white, but they would actually drink something better if they could have
a bottle, right? Exactly.
Then, you know, the 5 or 4 wines on your white by the glass list.
Exactly. So, I you know, just a little anecdotal things like that. And then separately, when we were opening Bar Henry, I was thinking about what I thought a wine bar should be about, and it seemed obvious to me that guests should have an opportunity to taste a lot of different things, and we shouldn't force people to, like, learn, you know, something. If they didn't want to learn anything, they just come in and order a glass of wine and sit and have a chat. But if someone wanted to learn something or do some kind of comparative tasting, they should be able to do that if they wanted. And so then, well, I think most wine bars' answer to that is to have a lot of stuff by the glass. But I always felt that that would lead to a lot of waste, and I didn't really want to do that. And I didn't want to have a Cruvenet system, and this is before the Coravin.
Yeah, I was thinking about that recently. I was going to ask. I wanted to ask you about this half bottle thing.
Yeah.
And I think now what a lot of people do is they Coravin it, right? Yeah. And so that other half bottle is good. If I remember, you put it on the chalkboard.
Yeah. So right? we had big glass mirrors in the bar at the Bar Henry, and I bought wax pencils, white wax pencils. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if I served a half bottle of something, there would then be two glasses available to sell. And I'd go and write it with the wax pencil
and then
the mirror.
So you could order one glass only.
Yeah, so then it would be two glasses of this, and it's this much a glass. Mm-hmm. And so it caught on to the point where people would come down the stairs. It was subterranean. They'd come down the stairs into the bar and go right to the mirror and see what was open.
That's great.
And, you know, be like, I'll have a glass of that. So basically I wanted to be able to, like, allow people to taste a lot of different stuff if they wanted, and not just, like, inexpensive stuff. There were about 150 wines that were like that, where you could order half. And I want to say they went up to like $180 a bottle or $150 a bottle or something like that.
Great.
So you could get half of one of those for $75.
Did you end up pouring out a lot of wine at the end of the night, or was it, do you guys take
a good job? Not when I was there. No.
Yeah.
I was, the whole game was...
You didn't pour it out because you drank it at the end.
Yeah. No. I drank a little bit for sure. But the whole game was... You know, competitively, like sell this one. Yeah, yeah.
So, have you been to a wine bar called Isola in Milan?
I have not.
Do you know of it? Do you know this place?
I've heard of it, but I don't.
You would love it. Oh, yeah? I think you would. I love it. Yeah. I went a few months ago with my girlfriend.
Yeah,
it's a great wine bar. They have every bottle of wine. Maybe my only criticism is that all the bottles are out and on like perfect temperature control. They have all these great bottles of wine out. And anything that you want, you can pull it and get a glass.
Okay.
You can like bring the bottle to the, like, and they'll open it up for you and they'll pour a glass.
Very nice.
And the prices are super low.
And then what do they do with the rest?
They try to sell it to...
I see, so they do the same.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I would just go and get them. But a lot of what I could tell the regulars who are going there speak to the bartenders, like, what do you have? Like, what should I drink? Right. And then they're trying to actively.
Right.
And there's like four people working behind this bar, and they do aperitivo, which generally, you know, I was excited about aperitivo as a college student.
Right.
And then as I grew up, and I was like, you know what? I'm willing to pay for food that's better than the crappy food.
Yeah.
But they actually have good, like, organic, like, cool ingredients that you don't see and stuff like that.
Nice.
Anyway.
Sounds ideal.
It's like an
ideal
glass
of wine,
place.
Whatever you want, and get some good food.
Yeah, and the food's included in the glass of wine. Awesome. We drank this wine, Lino Maga Barbar Carlo. I don't know if you're familiar
Never
with
heard
it.
Of it, no.
It's from right outside of Milan, 1996 for €16 a glass.
And amazing.
It's like amazing.
Yeah.
We should take a break right now. We're going to take just a very, very quick break. We'll be back with John Slover, the beverage director from The Grill and the Pool. And, right after this, we'll talk about those.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels to lower barrel entry proof before heat cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit michters.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
All right, we're back with John Slover, the beverage director of The Pool, The Grill, and the Lobster Club also?
The Lobster Club.
I had just this fantastically fun and delicious meal at the Grill, and I can't wait for the pool to open, but I don't know anything about the Lobster Club.
Sure.
I love lobster. it sounds cool.
I wonder if we're going to serve lobster. I don't even know. So basically, I'm sure many people know this, but the backstory of the place is that in 1959, Restaurant Associates, who were these very theatrical restaurateurs.
It was Joe Baum's company.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Opened the Four Seasons restaurant in the newly built Seagram's building, which is a revolutionary, modern, beautiful, elegant building in Midtown. It was the first of its kind. Actually, I guess Lever House was open the year before, was built the year before. But Mies van der Rohe, who was from the Bauhaus School of Architecture, designed, was the architect on the Seagram's building. Philip Johnson, who is a famous architect, was hired to design the interior spaces of the restaurants. Mm-hmm. And the result are basically that the most beautiful, most elegant, and most incredible interior restaurant spaces that I've ever seen. And I think are the only, it's the only landmarked interior space landmarked restaurant in the city, possibly in the country. They're treasures, really. So when Major Food Group partnered up with the owner of the Seagram's building, the Landmark Commission obviously dictated what they could and couldn't do, but in any, forget about that, they decided early on not to change anything, regardless of that, but just to take everything out, clean it, and put it back the way it was. A couple of minor changes here and there. There was a Picasso tapestry in the hallway between the restaurants. That was donated to the New York Historical Society, and they hired a sculptor to make this incredible organic sculpture that includes plants for that hallway. It's beautiful. One other thing they did was they took back what used to be called the Brasserie, which was a restaurant downstairs that was entered on from 53rd Street. It originally was owned by Restaurant Associates. Over the years, it became separately owned by different operators. So in the latter stages of the Four Seasons tenure, the Brasserie was not part of their operation. All they did was the grill in the pool, or the grill room in the pool room. But now the three restaurants are back together under one operator, one set of operators, which is Major Food Group. And
when will you guys open? And
we're going to open that in October, mid-October is the plan.
Will each of these places have different wine lists or own spirits?
It's all the same wine list. They each have different wines by the glass, the same wine list.
I'm excited for that.
Yeah.
I've been meaning to ask you, I know that Rich and Mario and the group really just did a ton of research into the space, to the food that was served there, and maybe I think also was served in general in great restaurants at that time. Was there a similar approach to the wine list and the cocktails?
Cocktails, yes. Wine list. I had a glance at the Four Seasons wine list. Stopped glancing at it.
Yeah.
But more to the point, I was, I learned a little bit about what the cuisines were going to be in the two restaurants, and thought about what wines would be appropriate. I mean, basically, in my experience, probably yours and everyone else's, people drink what they want to drink, and then there's a percentage of diners who care about, attempting at least to properly match wine and food and like that. So for the grill, because it's a chop house and we serve a lot of red meat and heavier weight food, I wanted to have, great representation from Napa Valley, from Bordeaux, from Southern Rhone, from Northern Rhone, from, Tuscany, from Piedmont and like that, have a lot of big reds, but a lot of Brunello di Montalcino. But knowing that down the road we were going to open the pool, which is, raw and cured fish and grilled whole fish. And, we have a little bit of, we offer some meat dishes, three meat dishes, but it's largely a seafood restaurant. I wanted to have a lot of champagne and a lot of Chablis and Meursault and coastal Italian whites and you know, briny coastal Mediterranean whites from all countries and islands. So I held off on the coastal Italian stuff until closer to the to when the pool opened, but I was picking out wines based on those two respective cuisines, and then just generally focusing on, you know, it's a big enough program and it's the kind of place where people drink what they want to drink. Mm-hmm. So I haven't worked that much in this part of Manhattan. And so I made some guesses about what should be on the list and started, and I'm still in the process of figuring it out. 2017 is about getting the places open, getting the place up and running, and seeing what people ask for. You know, is there a lot of demand for Australian wine? Mm-hmm. I don't want to buy Australian wine until I see if there's a demand or not for that. So I'm in the process of discovering what people want to drink.
Yeah,
but I knew that there were certain things I should have, which is the ones which are the
I know
ones
that
I
you
listed.
Favor old yeah. world wine.
Oh, for
have
sure.
You, have
definitely.
You
definitely
in the spirit of the Four Seasons yeah. being something more about American cuisine? Have you also added some more American wines that you would normally put on your own wine list?
For sure. Wine list. Yeah. 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 Definitely.
Yeah. Where do you go to when finding American wines
to
to list? I guess.
I mean, I have a pretty big selection of Cabernets and Cabernet blends from California, mainly Napa, but other places. I have a pretty big selection of Pinot Noirs from all over California and Oregon. And I have a pretty big selection of California Chardonnays. Mm-hmm. At some point, I want to get to maybe having something like a new California section.
That'd be cool.
Just to highlight, you know, something new that's happening that again, this is something that's come up while I've been out of the game a little bit. So I'm a little bit unfamiliar with these things. So it'd be a way for me to learn about sort of new California style of wine. But I think it would also make for something more interesting than just a long list of California Chardonnays. Same with Australia. There's a whole new movement of winemaking in Australia that I sort of missed because I wasn't mm-hmm. in the game while it was happening. And yeah, so you have
some really special wines on the list. Is there something that you've opened that you like that you were really excited about mm-hmm. That maybe you haven't tasted in a long time or ever before? Do you still get really excited about
yeah,
that?
Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I get really excited about for reds, red Burgundy, Northern Rhone, and Barolo and Barbareth Nebbiolo, the three grapes, which I think are the greatest: Pinot Noir, and Syrah, and Nebbiolo. So you know, there's a lot of tasting to do in those regions, mm-hmm. obviously, but Mark Sorel, the Hermitage producer, haven't had the wines that much. Mm-hmm. But I just opened up and served a bottle of 2001 Hermitage Grey Al, and it was great.
Wow!
It was amazing. I mean, I couldn't. It had been a while since I tasted it. I couldn't quite remember what it was like. But I thought it was fantastic. Super exciting when I, you know, do that. And of all things, a 2006 Muscadet. Which I thought was
really?
Amazing. I think it's Domaine Haute Bourg from, I think I pick it up from Polliner.
And that's current release?
That's
another one in some ways you could find, like,
some older.
And you guys have an extraordinary amount of Chateau Yquem, and it's displayed, like, super beautifully, and it's like a very artistic, backlit sort of way.
Yeah, well, we had this wine room just off of the pool in the hallway, at the end of the hallway on the way to the pool, just before you enter the pool dining room. And in, you know, the process of thinking about what to do with it, because it's not just a wine room, it's a display. There's a glass wall off of the hallway that you can look into it as you pass by. So it couldn't just be like some dirty, dusty, like wine storage. So I just, in thinking about it, we you know, there's a restaurant in Europe, I forget off the top of my head which one it is, but that they have this Ikem display, and it's gorgeous. All the different hues of orange and gold and yellow.
It's so beautiful.
And so we decided to recreate that with that. And so we, you know, figured out how to backlight it and put, you know, a kind of filter that accentuates the different hues.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
And what's the oldest vintage you guys have? Like early 19th century stuff?
We have an 1811.
What?
Yeah.
What's the oldest you've sold since you guys been open?
61.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
So we haven't gone back past 61, but we have multiple vintages from the 19th century.
It's incredible.
We have wines from the 20th century, from the teens, the teens, the 20s, 30s, 40s. Actually, the very cool, it's very cool. We have a bottle of 1911, a bottle of 1811, and we have some 2011.
No.
So my goal is to
sell it to
find
the
right table that will have, you know, two centuries.
Will you like buy their dinner for them if they get those three?
I'll buy their dinner, yes.
Not you personally, yeah.
I might do it personally.
I mean, that'd be incredible.
Yeah. No, I think that would be very cool. You know, so yeah.
Well, John Silver, it has been such a pleasure to have you on In the Drink.
It's been a pleasure for me too.
And maybe you, dear listener, could be the person who goes in and makes John's night by buying the three vintages, each, you know, 100 years apart, at the grill.
Right.
Either if you do that, or just even like go in for an extraordinary martini at the bar, and you'll feel just like super glamorous. Like,
yeah, it's a great place.
It's just a great place. Congratulations on the three stars. I'm sure there's more good things coming with the pool and the Lobster Club downstairs. Great.
And congrats to you about the upcoming Fausto.
Thank you so much.
Can't wait. Can't wait for that.
Thank you. Yeah, cool. Can't wait to have everyone in. I want to thank Dave Tadashore, who puts the show together every week. You're the man, Dave. Everyone at Heritage Radio Network. And, of course, to you guys for listening. Thanks so much. This has been In the Drink.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.